Well, welcome to the equity overview for the first quarter. I am glad to welcome Chuck Gibson, who, my partner at C-Lane and managing member of Financial Perspective, needs no introduction on the Solaria report. Chuck, it's been a very interesting first quarter. So we're going to start with a roundup, and then we're going to move into intermarket analysis. So first, let's start with the first quarter. Take it away.
Thanks, Catherine. It's great to be here. So let's roll right in the charts because we have 25 of them to look at tonight.
Uh-huh.
So the first chart is just a summary of what the indexes did during the first quarter. And you can see that they were either the stocks were mostly slightly up or some of them were slightly down. The interesting thing was that during the quarter, until the last week of the quarter, all the stock indexes were down. We had some mysterious buyers step in at the last minute and bring the indexes positive for the quarter. The other thing was interesting, bonds were up strongly and so were precious metals.
Right. And gold much better than silver.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Which that was a little, that made me a little concerned because if you expected precious metals to continue to rally, you'd hope to see silver leading gold. But in this case, it seemed more just the opposite.
Right.
So I'm concerned whether that was more geopolitical issues.
Right. And that was precious metals off of a bottom.
Yes.
At the end of the fourth quarter last year.
Yes.
And the bonds were a little bit of a surprise because we had Chairman Yellen saying interest rates were probably headed up.
Yep.
So suddenly yields start dropping and bonds start outperforming stocks. Anyway, but I would describe the first quarter as very choppy.
Yes. And are we acting as if we don't know what's happened since then? Because we continued that same path since.
Choppy, choppy, choppy.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. You want to roll right into the second chart, which is the sectors, U.S. sectors, and how they did.
Mm-hmm.
And what you see here is that healthcare, utilities, and materials and financials actually were the strong winners for the quarter. And what that showed you, the big losers were the cyclicals and, although it doesn't show it here, the industrials. And what that really shows in the staples, what you show is that there's been the first quarter was a start of a rotation out of the more higher beta stocks and into the more safer dividend paying less volatile stocks.
So this is where we know at the end of the quarter the announcement was that there was essentially no growth for the quarter.
Yep.
But this is where everybody goes when they're worried that we're starting to go into a slow economic period.
Correct. And I don't have it here, but we've talked about it before on the cycles of the economy. And at the end of your bull market part of the economy, when you're starting to go from a growth period into a recessionary period, what you tend to see are utilities, healthcare, and cyclicals leading the market. And that was a big warning flag for us.
Right.
Okay, let's move on to the next chart. A real eye chart here for everybody, but this is just a look at the global markets and what they did across the world. And just a couple of winners out of there were Italy, Argentina, and Egypt. And the losers, of course, were China, Japan, and Russia.
Yeah, the sanctions in the Ukraine was very hard on Russia.
Yes, it did not help there. And that's been continued on for the last couple months, too. All right, let's move right on to chart number four. This is a new chart I'm going to kind of bring forward and present continuously here. This, I think, it's very important to watch where the money flow is going. And this is just a flow of ETF money. It doesn't include mutual funds, but it does include a very large portion of the dollar. So it's real.
Right.
I think it's really important to watch where the strength and where the money is flowing into. And what you see here, at least in our regional areas, you'll see that the North America was strong, but what popped up at the last 2 months of the quarter was the emerging markets.
So the emerging markets started to perk up.
Absolutely. And you can see that. We'll show a chart of the emerging market stock market later on, but you notice that in the emerging market stocks.
One of the things I find interesting about looking at these flows is in the last chart you showed healthcare as being up. But when you look at the ETF flows, we're watching money flow out of healthcare in every month of the quarter, all 3 months.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right?
And that's not only that, you see that was the big loser for the quarter. And what you saw for the strength was in technology.
Right.
So that continued, but what you saw was a weakening demand because the first quarter was 500 million and then it went to 200 million and then it went to less than 100 million. So what you're seeing is while technology was strong for the quarter in itself, it started to get weaker and weaker as the quarter went on.
It's funny when you look at the numbers, the North American market is so huge compared to everyone else.
Yes.
And if you go, I went back historically and looked at how the emerging markets did.
Yep.
And over the entire period, they were kind of flat. But it was like a yo-yo, boing, 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 because when all it takes is a little bit of money to...
Yep. Right. And the final sector there are the commodity fund flows. And what you see, of course, was the precious metals was the big winner for the quarter when you look at the quarter in total. But we saw something that wasn't a good sign, which was we saw growth from January to February, but then we saw a quick reversal in money being pulled out of the precious metals market.
Well, the big loser is me when I go to the grocery store.
So. That's true.
So what I keep wanting to know is how can I invest in food? Because my prices are going up, so what's the flip side? So the agriculture, needless to say, the food commodities were up a lot in the first quarter.
Absolutely, and we'll talk about that a little bit later, but one real quick touch on that was that coffee was up over 100% for the quarter.
Just on my purchasing alone.
that's true. All right, let's go right into slide number five. And this is a look at just a reference of where we are in today's bull market. And what this tells us is that the current bull market is going on 266 weeks, which is the second longest bull market in history.
So let's go back.
Sure.
The longest was after October 1990.
Correct.
So that was 406 weeks.
Correct.
Then until recently, it was the one that started in October 2002. That was 261 weeks.
Yep.
We're now at 266 weeks.
Now, keep in mind, this is a couple of weeks old.
Right.
So we are now clear of those two benchmarks, and we're now breaching or going heading towards that old record that was, in the 1990s.
Right.
So, again, this just puts in perspective what people need to consider is that, we are getting long in the tooth. How much longer it can go, nobody knows. But, we're getting close to rarefied air.
Well, it's really funny because if you look at this, it's life before Alan Greenspan and life after Alan Greenspan.
Only you can come up with those analysis. But now that you pointed out, you're right. All right. I keep putting this up there because this is something everybody needs to be aware of. This is just a history of declines and how long it's been since our last decline of 10% or more or 15% or more or 20% or more. And what you see is that we are way beyond what is normal.
Now, I would like to point out, though, that the last time we showed this chart, we were way beyond normal on a 5% correction. We got that.
Correct.
Okay, so now we've wiped the slate clean on the 5%. Now we're 482 days overdue for a 10% or more correction, right?
Yes, and I will say this, though, that we, again, this only measures the S&P.
Right.
But, on some of our indexes that we're at today, we are at that 10%.
Right.
So, yes, as from this benchmark, we are still a long ways. We're still very stretched from the average.
Okay.
All right. I wanted to introduce your listeners to this index where we tend to reference the S&P 500 or the Dow. People have heard of that. And I think that those are good proxies for the U.S. stock market. But, if you're an investor, you really want to watch where the money is.
Right.
And where the money flows. And what the... This is called the institutional index. And actually what this is this is the top 75 most widely held stocks by institutions. And since institutions hold 80% or approximately 80% of all the invested money, it's important to watch what they're doing with their money.
So this is what the very biggest investors in the United States, the pension funds, the mutual funds, this is what they hold.
Yep, the hedge funds.
This is their biggest holdings.
Yep.
Hedge funds too.
So the top 75 of their biggest holdings. And so if you watch this, if they're selling, you're going to see it reflected in price.
Right.
And you and I know that price is really most important here.
Right.
So we watch this closely to see what it's doing. What you can see is I've highlighted this little pink area or rose-colored area. We're in a clear consolidation time.
Right.
We made a high in April, and you know, this is just a little bit, it's about a week late. What we have is we tested that high and we keep trying to get above that and we can't. And that's
if you look at that high, that is just a tiny bit more than the last three highs.
Absolutely.
So that's what I describe as choppy.
Yep.
And we're going sideways.
Well, the other thing that you notice is that that's a one-day or two-day spike. It's not a big deal. You're always going to get those highs and those lows, and they're not going to be perfect.
Right.
So in terms of matching. But that, to me, right there tells me that you've got a triple top in place.
Right.
And what we want is before we call a top, what we want to do is get confirmation.
Right.
So consolidation, just remind yourself and the listeners that consolidation is actually good for the market. This is where the bulls and the bears are fighting it out, trying to figure out who's going to win. We don't know who's going to win next, but the longer the consolidation period, the bigger the next move.
Well, remember, we did a Solari report about six reports ago in the equity overview where you talked about a sideways market.
Yep.
Remember?
Yep.
And
that's a sideways market.
That's a sideways market.
Yeah. Yeah. This is a very narrow range sideways market.
Right.
But it's a sideways market. And I do expect it, you know, the longer, like I said, the longer the sideways move, the bigger the move after that's going to come. So this is something to keep an eye on. All right, let's go to chart number 8. So I think I brought a different measurement. What this is a measurement of valuation, stock market valuations.
Right.
And last time I think I brought to you one methodology. And the problem is with one methodology, there's holes in every single one of the ways
right.
you
and
analyze
the last them. One we looked at was the Shiller PE.
Yes.
Right.
So what this is includes the Shiller PE, but includes three other ones. So what it is an average of an average. And it's trying to smooth out the ups and the downs. And so, you know, because what people can do is they can look at the Shiller and they say, well, the Shiller's fine, except it's got this weakness.
Right.
So what we're trying to do here is just bring in all of them and take an average and then compare that against history. And what it shows you is that we're currently at 79%, and that number doesn't really mean a whole lot, but what you should take note of is it's the third highest it's been.
Well, here, let me say it this way. What this is measuring is what kind of a multiple valuation you get from a dollar of earnings. So,
correct.
So a dollar of earnings translates into how much stock market value. And
correct.
What we're saying is there have been really only two times in history that you got a bigger bang for your buck in the stock market. One was in the roaring 20s, and the other was the tech bubble. Now we're at 79%. The roaring 20s were 89%. The tech bubble was 162. So it's more than double where we are now.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah. So that means it, you know, but what this is telling you, besides that, and that's a real good explanation. What this is telling you is that green line there is the mean. That's the average.
We're
and the further you get away from the mean,
above the mean.
Exactly.
Now, here's my other argument. The last two times we saw it spike,
yep,
were periods of introduction of new technology.
You mean, well, what was the new technology?
The roaring 20s.
Uh huh.
Telecommunications.
Oh, yeah.
And same with the tech bubble.
I don't remember that far back, so I'll have to trust you.
Well, I'm the older partner, see? So.
All right. Okay, so one of the things that, you know, I'll let the listeners in on, because they may not know this about you, a week doesn't go by where Catherine doesn't say, how are the emerging markets doing? Is it time to invest in the market?
Well, you know why? Because I like sales, okay? Think about it. I like the January sales.
Uh-huh.
If you look at, you're paying, you know, a multiple of 24 or 25 times for a dollar of income in the developed world,
yep,
in the S&P. If we go to the emerging markets, you've got great companies in markets with great growth rates that are trading at a multiple of 11.
Yep.
Okay. So it's my natural inclination to say, why should I pay 25 when I can pay 11? I'll buy 11. But then you'll say, no, 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 it could still be going down.
Right.
So I'm like, okay, when is the sale on?
Correct. And I'm in agreement with you. But the question is, we want to make sure that falling knife, we don't catch it.
Right.
So what this does is...
Because you keep saying, I keep saying, why not buy 11? You say, because we could buy at 8.
Yes. I'm a bigger tightwad than you are.
Yes, you are.
Okay. So what we saw in March was a breakout. And
uh-huh.
We have a downtrend that was consistent from the end of last year into this year, and that downtrend blue line was resistance. And what happened is we had a breakout of resistance at that point in time. That was a big flag to us to say,
right,
this is a potential buying opportunity.
Right.
Okay. But we didn't take it.
Right.
And there's a reason why. And if what I want to do is introduce the next chart, which is a same chart as what we're looking at, except it's a much longer period of view. And what this is, chart number 10, is a period that goes back since the bottom in 2009.
Right.
And what you see is we had a huge run up from the bottom in 2009. It was up more than 100%. And then we started this sideways chop.
Right.
And that sideways chop has been trending down. That trend, you can see, is defined by that upper solid blue line.
Right.
So if you take a look at the dotted blue line that I have there, that's the point from the prior chart where we broke out.
Right.
So what we would have done is if we would have bought that breakout as an investment, we would have run up against this potential much bigger and much more important line of resistance.
Right. And here I want to add another concern, and that is we're way overdue for a 10% or more correction in the U.S. market. If we get a 10% more correction in the U.S. market, what are the chances that this could also correct with it?
Well, if we go historically, it'll correct along with it, but not only correct along with it, it'll
more.
Correct more.
Right.
Yeah.
So
that's why you have to be nimble.
Right.
So what we did is we looked at this and we said the upside potential is, 7-8%. And where we're going to run into potential resistance. Did we want to take that risk? Well, what we did was we elected to step aside and say, if we break this trend line support, we'll go ahead and jump in. I have real doubts whether we're going to be able to do that, not because, the emerging markets has to continue to draw in money, but more importantly, look at where we are in the momentum.
Right.
The momentum is overbought already, and
right.
It's real hard for you to continue to push up farther when your momentum, the number of buyers, is at a max.
Right, right.
So this is just a little bit of a learning experience on how we elect to pick and select investment opportunities. All right, so you asked me to put this chart up.
Uh-huh. The post-Alan Greenspan years.
Yeah, this is since 2009. This is a chart. The blue line is the Fed balance sheet.
Mm-hmm.
And the black line is the S&P 500, our proxy for the United States stock market. And what you see is this unbelievably perfect correlation.
Right.
What this tells you is that as long as the Fed keeps printing money, stocks are going to go up to the moon.
Right. Now, they have been tapering, and we have been, as they've been tapering, we've been going sideways.
Coincidentally, isn't that interesting?
Now,
this is where I'm going to throw in this next chart because I like to play the devil's advocate.
Okay.
And I just think that you have to be careful on how you interpret these kinds of charts. There's a saying in science and statistics that says, correlation does not imply causation.
Right.
And so what this says is that there's a great correlation here, but let's look at the next chart, which is the exact same chart, except it goes back to all the way to 1980.
Right.
And what you see is there's no correlation at all until about 2008.
Although what I would say is if you look at that as a correlation, the law of diminishing returns is set in.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. So all I want is just people, it's called the Greenspan. It was called the Greenspan put. Now it's referred to as the Yellen put. But
right.
You really have to be careful in making the assumption that as long as the Fed is continuing to, expand their balance sheet, that stocks are a good pick.
Right.
That's all I'm saying.
Right. I agree.
Okay. All right. Well, that's it for the first section. And we can.
So before we move on.
Yep.
So essentially what we've had is very, very choppy.
Yep.
And we know we're coming into summer.
Yep.
We should mention 95% or more of the gains in the S&P traditionally have come between.
It's normally May. Let me just say this. And it's called sell in May and go away.
Right.
It's normally the reference time period is May to October. But I will say this. May. You kind of have to discount May because May is the second strongest month of the year.
Right.
December is the first. May is the second. So it's really not May. It's really June from October.
Right. Okay. So we're way overdue for a correction.
Yep.
The market has reached an all-time high, but it's going sideways.
Yep.
The Fed's tapering.
Yep.
And we're coming into summer.
Yep.
Is there any other reason to be nervous?
I don't think we have enough time for me to go through all the other list of things. I mean, look at the underlying components, and I don't have charts, but I won't bore your listeners, but the underlying components of the actual stock market is getting weaker and weaker. You look at the number of stocks making all-time new highs. You look at this number of stocks below their moving averages. It's just not a pretty picture.
Right.
And that's the underlying part that tells me that unless that changes soon, you know, we're going sideways right now, but
The bungee rope of corporate earnings has gone about as far as it can go.
Oh, there's one other point.
Yeah.
That I forgot to mention, since you were asking for negatives. We forgot to mention the second year of a presidential election even worse on a midterm election year.
Right.
So we have not only the second year, which is the worst year, but you have midterm elections, which compounds all that. So other than that, it's rosy.
Okay, so Intermarket Analysis, you are the person who introduced me to Intermarket Analysis. I did portfolio strategy that included things like this, and you got me to read a fabulous book that I want to mention. But so why don't you start off and tell us what Intermarket Analysis is, why it's important, and tell us a little bit about the book that you used to introduce me to it.
Okay, so you know, I'm going to kind of split this into two sections because you can look at Intermarket Analysis and it's more like economic theory.
Right.
Now, but it's a little bit better than economic theory. But what I want to do is then take – that will be the first section, is just to introduce your listeners to that. But the second section was let's apply some realistic, real-time applications and see what happens and how we can use it.
Right.
Okay? So let's go into the story behind Intermarket Analysis. It's the study of how various financial markets are related to each other. While it's widely accepted and considered a very popular branch of technical analysis now, it hasn't always been that way.
Right.
And the father of Intermarket Analysis is John Murphy. And he started writing about it back in the early 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing was that the body that manages the technical analysis, the world wide body of technical analysis study, when John submitted his first paper to the MTA, which is the body, they rejected it for lack of proof.
You're kidding.
No. And so he looks back at that today, and now he's a member of the MTA, and he is one of the founding fathers of this branch. And it's so funny because of that reason. You know, he didn't have enough data and support to be able to do it back then, but now it's now fully encompassed within the MTA.
Wow.
Anyway, so let's go on. Intermarket analysis is really typically, it just revolves around the four main asset classes. So that's about, or in fact, what we're going to look at, it is going to be looking at stocks, bonds, commodities, and then the currencies.
Right.
We're not going to look at all currencies. We're just going to look at the dollar.
Okay.
Okay. But actually, you and I looked at, you can use it to look at anything.
Well, I don't know if you remember, one of my favorite commercials was the Pillsbury Doughboy. You squeeze one place and it pops out another.
Right.
And one of the reasons I love financial markets is because everything is connected.
Yep.
And when you work on portfolio strategy, when you work on investment, you know, you're dealing with markets where literally you can have something happen over here and major impact on the other side. Everything is connected. And to me, Intermarket Analysis is simply trying to create a sort of a rigorous, disciplined way of looking at the connections between things.
Yep.
Okay.
And that's a real good explanation. I don't do a great job. That's why you're here on the show with me. But you're absolutely right. And I will go back to one point, was that this whole study was not even – everybody thought that they were independent markets of themselves.
And you're kidding.
No, there was no relationship prior to the 1990s. There was no relationship between bonds. There was no relationship between stocks. Everybody thought each market was in and of itself.
Well, I'll tell you a very interesting thing, because we – you know, I was at that period – in Washington, and I was responsible for portfolio strategy for the FHA, first as the commissioner and then as their financial advisor. And what was interesting is there was a group of people who were very knowledgeable about federal credit and federal budget, and we would talk about what would happen if government policy did this, then this would happen to these markets. Mm-hmm. So we were doing intermarket analysis, but not from the point of markets, from the point of view of government policy related to what it would do to the markets, and we always spoke that way. And so I didn't know that the market guys weren't doing it.
Nope.
Because, you know, the federal weenies were doing it.
Well, I'll leave it at that.
Okay.
You can call them that because you were there.
Okay.
So, you know, if you're, so one example would be to show how the relationship between stocks and bonds.
Right.
So if you're investing in stocks, you kind of have to watch bonds. It's a much bigger market, because what tends to happen is that bond yields tend to trend in the same direction as stocks. So right. we'll go look at some examples for this. I'm just giving you a quick overview. So in many cases, the other thing that's why it's important is because in many cases, the bond market will lead the stock market. You'll start to see a move in yields before you start to see a move in stocks. So a move in yields lets you know that you should be careful, because there might be some, you know, you're squeezing the doughboy down here and there might be a move in stocks.
Now, when you're saying that, you mean stock prices or the yields that you're getting from stocks?
Good question. It's stock prices.
Okay.
Because everything that we talk about are prices here. Now, what I've done is on the charts, I've taken prices out so we can just focus on yield.
Okay.
And, you know, there's other correlations, such as if you're a bond investor, you really need to watch the commodity markets.
Okay.
Because commodities, you know, as bond yields rise, commodities rise too.
Okay.
So that's an inflationary issue. The one thing about the bad thing, I would say, about intermarket analysis is the fact that there are no guarantees, because what you have is this trend, this relationship, but that relationship doesn't always hold.
Right.
So not only that, when it does hold,
it speaks to probabilities.
Correct.
Right.
Correct. But I mean, that's why when you look at this, you can't just hang your hat and say, whatever it says, I got to do. Not only does it not always hold, but when it does hold, it doesn't give you an alarm clock telling you exactly this is the time to make the move.
Right.
So it's really just about the relationships, but they're important relationships. So let's close out this section. You know, I wanted to bring up the fact that you know, the economists tend to look at statistics to determine the direction of the economy.
Right.
So the chartists or intermarket analysis actually look at the markets themselves. And there's a big difference, because the economic statistics are by nature backward looking.
Well, they used to be. Now they're just made up.
Okay, now they're backward looking made up. Okay, but the markets are forward-looking entities, right? They're always referred to as a discounting mechanism. So, you know, the fact that stocks anticipate the economic trends 6 to 9 months before they actually move.
Right.
So this is why it makes bonds, you know, an even earlier economic indicator than stocks.
Right.
So the way I look at it is that this analysis really provides, or can help provide, an investment edge.
Okay.
It's not guaranteed. It's kind of like if you're, you know, able to count cards. You can actually do better than the house when you're in Vegas.
Right.
But in my mind, you got to arm yourself with as many tools as you possibly can. And this is one of those, you know, one of those tools that provide you greater odds to, you know, beat the high frequency trading computers. All right. Let's take a look at just the relationship on a chart standpoint. So let's take a look at first chart number 13. And this is, everybody knows this. This is just confirmation to reflect that. What this shows is bond price and bond yield. We all know that bond prices and yield move inversely. This is just a visual image.
I would like to point out, when I went to Wharton Business School, it took me 9 months to get this into my head, that when the price of a bond goes up, the yield goes down.
Yes.
Okay?
Yes.
And when the yield goes up, the price of the bond goes down.
Yes.
I don't know why it took me 9 months. Once I got it, it was like riding a bicycle. Yeah. So now it's...
Don't feel bad, because I had the same problem too. I just didn't go to Wharton Business School.
Okay.
Let's move on to chart number 14. This is a chart that shows bond yield versus commodities. The blue line is the commodity index, and the black line is bond yields.
So this one has always surprised me, because I always thought if interest rates went up, then the carrying cost of commodity inventories would get more expensive and commodities would go down. But that's clearly not what this is saying.
Yeah, and you threw me a curve there, because I wasn't expecting that. I didn't think about that. Well, the way I think of it is that when interest rates are rising, you are in an inflationary environment.
Right. So the value of commodities.
So the value of commodities tend to stay, you know, constant as with inflation.
Right.
So commodities are more of an inflation hedge than they are anything else. And you notice that I've highlighted a couple of gold areas there. They're areas of divergence where yields and commodity prices don't or haven't moved in the same direction.
Right. So starting in spring of 2013, we saw yields move up.
Yep.
And commodities stayed flat. Now they're moving up a little, but yields are coming down a little.
Yep.
Right.
Yep. And what that tends to tell you normally when that happens, that's because of an inflation or a deflationary move.
Right.
Okay. So the bond market is really smart. They're the biggest market in the world, and they anticipate those things first. So it's always good to watch them.
Right.
Now, it could be just a fake out, but it's something that's, you know, raising a flag saying what's going on here.
Right. Okay. It's real. I keep thinking, I know I've said this in the Slayer Report before. I love the expression of Jim Carville, who said, when I die, I want to come back. I want to be reincarnated. Right. It's a bond market because you can control everybody.
Absolutely. The next chart is a chart of bond yields, which is in black. And background.
Okay, so the black is the 10-year Treasury yield.
Correct.
Okay.
And the reason why I switched, the others were the 20-year. The reason why I switched is because there's a very, very good correlation that's well known on the stock market that the traders use, and that's the 10-year yield.
Right.
So they move in the same direction, just not as much as the longer maturities.
Okay.
So one thing is that you can see here that generally stocks tend to move with bond yield.
Right.
And the other thing that you can take from this is that you can look is that bond yield peaks and bottoms have created inflection points for, you know, good inflection points, early warnings that stocks have hit a bottom or have hit a top.
Right.
So interestingly enough, if you just look at where we're at today, we saw
yields are falling.
Yeah, we saw a bond yield that
started to fall. Janet Yellen warned us that the yields were going to go up, and so that's why they're coming down.
Exactly,
obviously.
That's a head fake. But we had a peak in January or December of 2013,
uh-huh.
And we started to see bond yields start to fall, and this is when we're starting to see a little weakness. Now, what there tends to be is a little bit lag from the time that bonds move to the time that stocks actually react.
Right.
So this is right in line with what we're seeing.
So if the historical patterns hold, which they can or cannot, stocks would start to come down.
Right.
Right.
And,
okay.
And if we start to see bonds fall even further,
right,
that's not such a good sign for stockholders.
Right.
All right. Last chart I have for this is actually the yield, the bond yield to the dollar. So I'm not sure which drives which, but what you can see is there's a very good correlation.
There's an amazing correlation.
Yeah, there is. And that's kind of what you'd expect.
Now, obviously, we're looking at bond yields on dollar-denominated
correct.
Debt. Okay.
Correct.
Okay.
So if you were to look at other currencies, then you'd have to, you know, it would throw you a completely different curve. That's why,
right.
You know, the intermarket analysis study can be applied to anything. But, you know, you can – I just wanted to look at the framework of what we were warned. We were warned by Janet Yellen that we potentially could have higher rates.
Right.
And what the impact would be to other
markets.
Investment vehicle or markets.
Right. Now, what's interesting is the dollar looks very soft right now.
Yes.
And we almost wonder if we're not coming into an inflection point.
Yes. Yes. But, you know, the miserable thing is that the dollar, it moves so slowly normally, and you just want to hurry up and would you get off the dime and do something? Because the sideways move is killing me.
No, it's chop, chop, chop. We're going sideways.
Yeah, but watch out when it makes a move, though.
I know. I know.
All right, let's move on to the next section. And this is where I'm going to come up with some real life applications of how to use intermarket analysis and what historical examples.
Right.
So what we have here is a chart of the CRB, which is the commodity index.
Right.
And what you see, it's been in a severe downtrend since 2011.
Now, that's a basket of all the different commodities. So it's got the base metals, it's got the energy commodities, it's got the food commodities. It's a pretty wide basket.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And that's why we look at it. So there are things within, and the next chart will show you that there are things within the basket that might be moving against the general trend.
Right.
So that's why I'm using this example.
Right.
But what you see is in early part of this year, we had a breakout from that downtrend line.
Okay.
And that was caused by, we don't know yet, but let's take a look at some subcomponents of the CRB here. And these are just four that I presented.
Okay.
So
beef.
Red is, you can see that beef is up substantially.
Actually, yeah.
Oil was up.
Yeah.
Agriculture is the ones that you were talking about. So that's
right.
Corn and wheat.
Right.
And then we look at the base metals. What's
going
on?
Boy, this looks just like my grocery bill.
Well, buy base metals for groceries instead.
Too bad I don't need copper. I'd be much better off.
Exactly. So what you see here is a divergence.
Right.
And what I want to do is look at the base metals and see what's going on.
Right.
So let's take a look at the next chart. And herein points out that what we are looking at copper here. And
yeah.
It's a comparison of copper, which is the gold line, and you have the CRB index, which is the green line. You can see they moved very consistently. They were both in a downtrend since 2011. And lo and behold, early part of 2014, we had a breakout in the CRB, which is the index. But we had what? A divergence. Copper's coming down.
Right.
So what's the cause of that? That's intermarket analysis. So you have to look no further than the next chart. And this
China.
Tells you, yep, this is a relationship between copper, which is the gold line, and the Chinese currency, the yuan, in the black line. And you can see that because, and it kind of makes sense because China is the largest consumer of copper.
Right.
So their demand is going to be dictating the price of copper.
Right.
So this is something that if you were a copper trader, you'd be more willing or more apt to be watching, you know, the Chinese currency than you would the actual commodity index.
Right.
Okay, that's the first example. Let's move on to the next one. Everybody's favorite.
Gold.
Gold. So this is a long-term trend line of gold. You can see it's been a, it was, not anymore. It was in a very nice uptrend.
Right.
We had a, so the gold is, the gold line is the price of gold, just to let everybody know. And those blue trend lines actually contain the movement of gold through
right.
its up and down movement.
Right.
Okay. What we had was we had a breakout of that trend line in the middle of 2011.
Right.
We had, that's called a throwover. And you can also see right at that same point in time, if you look at the very top pane, we had a major top in the momentum index.
Right.
That's why it's worthy of watching that. So what happened was is we had a fall back down into the trend line.
Right.
And we went chop.
Right.
Right. And that chop was quite a ways, quite a long period of time, and it was miserable to be in.
Yes, we I remember.
I know you do. So do I. And what we see is that we had a break of that trend line right in about April of 2013.
Right.
So why don't we take a look at the next chart, which kind of gives some support as to the main, the possible reasons why. I know there are some other people that have maybe other reasons, but let's take a look at the next chart. So this, what this is a chart of gold, which is the gold price. The gold price is the gold line, and the black line is the S&P 500.
Right.
Okay. So look at what happened. We were that's that what
See,
I've highlighted.
See, this was what was so mysterious to me is they were both, as the Fed was engaged in quantitative easing, they
yep.
were both moving up together.
Yep.
And then suddenly the S&P kept going, and we know commodities started dropping and gold goes sideways and then down and they cross.
So watch, look at how interesting this was. We were in that consolidation period.
Right.
And remember, I wanted everybody to remember we were talking about stocks. The wider the consolidation, the bigger the drop or the
right.
rise. So what we had was look at where it dropped, where it broke that trend line, which was in April of this, of 2013.
Uh-huh.
And bring your eyeballs down to where it intersects with the S&P 500. And that was exactly the time when the S&P broke out to new highs.
Right.
So my theory behind this is that, look, investors are looking for gains.
Right.
They're
going
to go wherever the strongest market is. Now, there's those other people that
So you're saying they're rebalancing out.
I'm just saying I'm going to go wherever gains are or wherever the strength is. And we've broken out to all-time new highs. That tells me that we have potentially higher to go on the stock market. Why do I want to be in gold if I'm at best going sideways?
Right. Right.
The world, I view the world as one big investment pool, and money's shifting and rotating at all times. You got to be going where the money's going.
I don't see it as one big investment pool. I see it as one big investment pool where the pool has expanded dramatically in the last 10 years in size.
Oh, that's true.
And so if you look at what's swinging around looking, I think part of the choppiness in the markets is you have so much cash. I mean, the surveys at the beginning of the year said, you know, families with wealth had 40% of their money in cash.
Ah, yeah.
Okay, so you have so much money looking for a safe place to go.
Yep.
So.
Yep, and gold was that safe haven
for
the last decade prior to 2013.
Well, it's very interesting. If you look at the Gallup poll that I had up on the blog recently, gold has come down. It was in the mid-30s in terms of preference by American
yep.
investors.
Yep.
So that it's come down from 24. Stock market has come up to 24. So gold and stocks are now 24% say it's their preferred investment, but we now have 30% saying it's real estate.
Yeah.
So now housing is slowing down. So It's almost as though they're all three of them are kind of merging, and we're getting into a position of balance.
Yeah, yeah, no, well, things tend to get in excess, right?
Yeah.
And it's how far stretched you are away from that mean, and then they move back.
Yeah.
So in my mind, gold was in a huge uptrend for a very long period of time, and you expect a kind of a whipsaw.
Well, now what's interesting is if you see what's happening to physical, you're getting a much broader ownership of gold, because gold was a very thin market,
yes.
Not just in terms of size, but in terms of who owned gold, very small, low participation rates. You're getting a much healthier participation rate now.
And that's good.
That's good.
For the long-term value.
For the long-term.
Yep, yeah. Absolutely. All right, this is my final real life example, and
okay.
I think this is, you know, I'm a geek when it comes to these kinds of things. I really love these kinds of opportunities, and so what I did was I put together a little model for everybody and how to use intermarket analysis. This is just a chart of the relationship between the S&P 500 and the 30-year Treasury bond, and as you can see, it goes up and it goes down. That's in the first top pane. The lower pane is the S&P 500, just so you can reference it.
Right.
Okay? So remember that chart, because we're going to move on, and I'm just going to add to it. The second chart for this thing, all I've done is applied a slower moving average and a fast moving average.
Okay.
So the green line that I've added there, it may be hard to see, but you squint real hard, you'll see a green, and that's a 20-week moving average.
Okay.
And the red line is a 100-week moving average.
Okay.
There's nothing magical about those. I just pulled them out of the air, and because those are typical averages that people, investors use or traders use.
Right.
So what I did was is on those blue lines, those vertical blue lines, those are the points at which the 20-day or 20-week moving average has crossed over or under the 200-day moving average, 200-week moving average. Sorry.
Okay.
And what I've done is that is a model. So what I've done is said when the 20-week moving average crosses under the 200 or the 100 moving average, which the first one would have been the end of 2000.
Right.
You get out of stocks.
Right.
And you go into the 30-year Treasury bond.
Right.
So you stay in the 30-year Treasury bond until you get a crossover.
Okay.
That happened in latter quarter of 2003.
Okay.
You stay in United States stocks until you get the next crossover, and then you go all the way over to 2008.
Okay.
Okay? And you would have gotten out of stocks, and you've gotten into the 30-year bond.
Right.
So you continue this forward all the way to present.
I was a chicken. I just stayed in cash all the way down. I got out of stocks in April. Yeah, just about here. But I stayed in mostly cash.
Well, that in which case, cash was okay, but you did a much better with a 30-year
bond. Yeah.
And then what you see is a bunch of, there's four blue vertical lines compressed there together. That's called a whipsaw. And I've incorporated that in. So what I've done is I just created this simple model and said, if you would have followed this example, the simple model, and invested your money in 100% in the stock market when it says the model says to, or you move 100% to the 30-year Treasury bond, let's take a look at the chart and see how that worked out for you.
Right.
Okay? Because so what I'm comparing it against is if you would have just bought and held.
Right.
Because, you know, investors, they don't necessarily have methodologies. What I'm doing is creating a very simple methodology that you can use.
Right.
So the final and last chart here, to try and create, you know, I didn't want somebody to say, well, you're selectively picking the absolute wonderful, most beneficial entry point. I've used point A and point B, which was the bottom in 1995 and the top in 2000.
Right.
So I picked those as a worst case examples, and I've ended it where we are today.
Okay.
Okay. So if you just take point A, which is the start in 1995, to where we are today, and you follow that same methodology that I tried to describe there, if you would have bought and held, your $100,000 investment would today be worth $417,000.
Okay.
Okay. If you would have followed the moving average, the simple moving average crossover, you would have had
$662,000. Right.
Substantial difference.
Okay.
Okay. Now, if you would have taken point B, which was a much worse scenario, buy and hold would have gotten you $142,000.
So if I took my 100 and I just stayed in the stock market,
yep.
I would have $142,000.
Correct.
Okay.
So you're up. But if you would have followed the model at this point in time, instead of $142,000, you had $225,000.
So it's basically saying risk off, risk on.
That's exactly what this is. This is my risk on, risk off chart.
I'm going to take risk during this period,
yep.
Then I'm going to take risk off.
Yep.
So when let's go back to what you said about sell in May and go away.
Yep.
That's basically saying June to November is risk off time.
Correct.
Okay.
Now, if you look at today where we are, it's not anywhere close to having a crossover.
Right.
Right? But that can change real quickly as the market starts, if it starts to fall. I'm not saying that's what it's going to do, but you can do much more refined methods to improve this simple trading methodology or investing methodology. Here's what I find that most investors struggle with is they can buy. They just have trouble selling.
Right.
And this actually provides you a good time to sell, but it also provides you a good time to buy. And it also removes all the thinking
it's
out of
simple.
It. It's simple.
It's simple.
And you don't have to rationalize and justify why you're doing it because the model tells you what to do.
Right.
So.
Well, and what it says is what we know. Nothing goes up forever.
Right.
Right.
And you need to be nimble in determining when that time to enter and exit, this will help you do.
Right. Right. This is one of the charts or the concepts that persuaded me out of buy and hold.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I did want to give one final kudos to, you know, John Murphy, who was the godfather of intermarket analysis. And I wanted to just, if you don't mind, reference his book.
This is a wonderful book. I love this book.
Well, actually,
it's on my den table.
What I'm actually doing is not referencing your book because he's made three books since then. And it's basically the same book that you have.
Yeah.
But what it is it's a more recent version.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the exact same thing. It's just a little prettier and cleaner. What it's called is the Trading with Intermarket Analysis, a Visual Approach to Beating the Financial Markets Using Exchange Traded Funds.
Ah.
So he threw in the exchange traded funds.
Well, you know me. I'm not that big on exchange traded funds.
I know. But the fact is all he was trying to do is use examples to illustrate his intermarket analysis.
Well, actually, I love to use exchange-traded funds to track things.
Yes.
Yeah. So they're very good to track things.
Yep.
Okay.
That's it.
Okay. Well, Chuck, I can't thank you enough. This has been fascinating.
Well, it's been fun. Thank you, and I look forward to next quarter.
Okay.